Welcome to the Just Pod, a podcast by the Criminal Justice Section of the ABA, the unified voice of criminal justice.
Welcome to this episode of the Just Pod. Today, we're speaking with Matt Riedel, who has recently retired as Sheridan County's prosecuting attorney. He served as the prosecuting attorney for 32 years. And Matt is currently serving within the criminal justice section as the co-chair of the Forensics Ethics Task Force and has also served as the chair of the section a couple of years ago. So Matt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Emily.
Today, we're going to talk about forensic science being used as evidence in the courtroom. So, Matt, why don't you get us started by talking about how long forensic science has been used in the courtroom?
Well, Emily, I'm a little reluctant to try to identify a particular event or date as the start of the use of forensic science in a courtroom because as soon as I do that, somebody's going to point to some earlier event or some earlier application as preceding whatever event I identify. Suffice it to say that long before we had our DNA wars of the early 1990s, there were the arsenic wars of the early 1800s that were playing themselves out in the courtrooms in England and France and the United States.
Well, that's fair. Well, then let me ask you this. How has the law regarding scientific or technical knowledge evolved over time?
Well, as best I can tell, at the time of the arsenic wars, it seems that the legal fight was principally a factual one with competing experts appearing in trials and other proceedings, contesting the methods, the techniques, and the conclusions of the different scientists involved and why their opinion was better than that of their opposing colleagues. And those arguments were made in courtrooms and in classrooms, textbooks, journals, and even in general print newspapers of the time. Then in 1923, in the case of Fry versus the United States, the D.C. Court of Appeals issued a short citation-free opinion that passed on the question of the admissibility of scientific principles or techniques. And Fry said to be admissible, the scientific principle or technique must have achieved general acceptance within the relevant scientific community. The technique involved in the Fry case was admissibility of a primitive forerunner of the polygraph or lie detector test. And the Fry test gained a great deal of traction in the Federal Circuit, and it filtered down to the state courts as well. And though there were still some significant questions about the utility of Fry, it gained traction in a large number of jurisdictions in the country. And then following the adoption of the Federal Rules of Evidence, some federal courts continued to follow Fry. And some states adopted, then turned around and adopted the Federal Rules of Evidence. And in neither instance did they necessarily provide guidance as to whether or not Fry was included or excluded in the federal rules. Some states that adopted the Fry rule then started to tinker with the test by adding other components to take care of different areas of dissatisfaction that they had with Fry. And then finally in 1993, the U.S. Supreme Court decided the Daubert decision, Daubert versus Dow Pharmaceuticals, which decided the question of whether or not the Fry test remained the test of admissibility in the federal courts. And that opinion held that the general acceptance test was not the test to be applied in the federal courts under Rule 702. Rather, it was one of several factors to be considered by the court. And those factors included relevance and evidentiary reliability. And the court in the Daubert case said, in considering reliability, courts need to consider different factors that underlie reliable scientific knowledge. And that included whether it was falsifiable, whether it had been subject to peer review or publication, and its known or potential error rate, and whether the testimony pertains to scientific knowledge is a question of whether or not the theory or methodology will assist the jury and whether it can be tested, that is it falsifiable?
So how has the bench and the bar fared in applying these scientific concepts, especially in cases where scientific or technical testimony is offered?
Well, there were some cautionary signs about the ability of courts to evaluate those concepts right from the start. Chief Justice Rehnquist, in the Daubert decision, issued an opinion dissenting in part and concurring in part, and he pointed to a particular sentence in the majority opinion that quoted from a number of treatises which not only spoke of empirical testing, but one of which quoted, "The criterion of the scientific status of a theory is its falsifiability or refutability or testability." He said, "I defer to no one in my confidence in federal judges, but I'm at a loss to know what is meant when it's said that a scientific status of a theory depends on its falsifiability." And I suspect many of my colleagues may too.
Mm-hmm.
But rather than just rely upon the Chief Justice's comments about concerns in that area, I would point to the 2009 report of the National Academy of Sciences on forensic science titled Strengthening Forensic Science. And there, the National Academy really pointed out that there are some pretty severe need for more education in the forensic sciences for both attorneys and judges. And if you think about it, if you're in an area where there's a lot of science being presented or being introduced or used in cases that you may have representation responsibilities or you may be presiding over, our ethical duty to be competent in those areas really requires us to do what we can to try to improve our ability to understand and evaluate that evidence and that information.
Right. I imagine it's difficult to keep up because, as you've already stated, there are many changes and developments that continue to come forward in forensic evidence in the courtroom. So what is available to attorneys and judges to manage that as they continue in their work to stay on top of these developments and, you know, increase their understanding of forensic evidence?
Well, the National Academy pointed to educating, having the forensic science community educating those who use their services, and that there's a need to understand the services and to understand the terminology, not just of forensic science, but of science generally. And they talked about how users of forensic science analysis includes law enforcement officers, forensic pathologists, the bar, judiciary, general public, and policymakers, and that we also need to seek education from the broader scientific community. In recent years, judges have struggled to understand complex scientific evidence that gets presented before them that might involve epidemiology and toxicology studies. And so they pointed to a lack of programs that tackle this specific problem. And this is where the training that we're going to talk about here in a little bit tries to bridge that gap and tries to provide that kind of information. These are programs that also look at a variety of kinds of forensic evidence and how their interacting processes operate, work, and they give special attention to individualization and identification issues. That is, for instance, a statement that this particular item of evidence was handled by or came from a specific individual to the exclusion of all others. The National Academy pointed out that there's value in the bar and bench understanding the evidentiary value and the evaluation of evidence, the weight of the evidence and how what that weight is according to science. There's a need for attorneys to understand critical issues about quality assurance and quality control, about the probabilistic opinions that experts are sometimes asked to provide in the course of a trial or other forms of litigation.
So what sort of knowledge are attorneys or judges coming to their professional fields with Is there a lot of education opportunity in their formal education at the universities, or are they dependent on programs that highlight forensic evidence to become educated and knowledgeable in these areas?
Well, what the National Academy suggested was that they suggested that it may be too late for people that have already left law school. I don't think that's correct, but they did indicate that there are more law schools that are beginning to try to show or at least introduce the topic to students. I think that that's a helpful step, but it's very early on and not all law schools offer those kinds of opportunities. They did indicate that there is value in what different organizations, prosecution, defense organizations, the American Bar Association, different organizations can bring to the table in terms of trying to raise the level of understanding of prosecutors, defense attorneys, and judges.
So speaking of the American Bar Association and the programs they offer, the section hosts a conference annually in New York that you are the chair of or co-chair of as well. And this provides educational opportunities. Why don't you tell us what we can expect from this year's institute? It looks like you're going to have reports from a number of organizations like OSAC and CSAFE and even a report from the DOJ. Why don't you tell us more?
I would love to. And this is a program that really attempts to bridge the gap that the National Academy identified and to raise the level of awareness and understanding of the bench and bar. It's actually our 10th annual program, and it'll be held at Fordham University School of Law on May 29th and 30th.
That's right after Memorial Day, right?
It is. It is. And you asked a minute ago about lawyers keeping up with developments. One of our panels really, I think, will provide a great deal of assistance in that regard. There is, within the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which is a part of the Department of Commerce, there is a federally funded organization of scientific area committees for forensic science. It's called OSAC. And we have one panel that is going to report from OSAC. And it's about the forensic science standards that have come out of OSAC and what officers of the court need to know. It's really making standards more visible, telling practitioners how they can access those standards. And it concludes with a real-life example of how a discipline-specific standard was used in a court proceeding and how it ultimately impacted the outcome of that proceeding. So that's one example. We also have another panel that I think people will find very interesting, too, and that's on the role and validity of proficiency testing in laboratories' quality management systems. The administration of proficiency tests in forensic science laboratories has been used for years as part of their quality assurance programs to test proficiency of the examiners and, in some cases, the laboratory itself. And oftentimes you'll see attorneys use that to buttress the court's view of competency, expertise, or the qualifications of an expert to testify. What this is about is that they had three attorneys with no training or experience in comparing latent fingerprints and known prints, and they had them each take a friction ridge proficiency test, and they'll talk about the results of that test, and they'll talk about the conclusions that people might draw from the results of the test. What makes this particularly interesting is we'll have one of the attorneys, a public defender from Cook County, Illinois. One of the three attorneys will be on the panel, as well as a representative of ANAB, the National Accreditation Board that accredits the vast majority of laboratories in the country, and a representative of a company that probably provides most of the proficiency tests being used in forensic laboratories today. I think that'll be very interesting and eye-opening. We have some other really outstanding programs. Eric Drogan, professor from Harvard University, and Chris Lobogan, professor at Vanderbilt School of Law, are going to be speaking on different issues in forensic psychology related to the competency of a defendant to proceed. They'll talk about the methods and standards and the ethical obligations to determining mental fitness to proceed, and the defense desire to discontinue medication in some instances in order for the jury to see how the defendant might have been affected by their mental illness at the time of the offense. I think that's really going to be very interesting. One that I'm really looking forward to is we have Dr. S. James Gates. Jim Gates, he's actually a rocket scientist. He's a physicist. And he's going to talk about the issue of falsifiability so that if you didn't know what it was before, if you were stumped by the concept as Chief Justice Rehnquist was in Daubert, Jim Gates is going to explain what falsifiability is all about and why it dominates science and scientific knowledge. And I think that'll be a lot of fun and a very interesting presentation as well.
Well, that sounds like a great program. And for those listening that are interested in attending it, again, this will take place at Fordham University in New York City on May 29th and 30th. And you can go onto the ABA's Criminal Justice Section website to register to attend. So thank you again, Matt, for taking the time to talk to us about forensic evidence and sort of its evolution in the courtroom, and also to share highlights from this year's Forensics Institute. We look forward to hearing more.
Thanks, Emily. I really enjoyed it.
And thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of The Just Pod.